Getting back to business across Harvey-hit Texas. There's no holiday weekend for roughly 1 in 3 in the Lone Star State. That and much more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Hey, I'm David Brown. The mucking, the cleanup, the drywall, the carpet, the debris left behind by Harvey. Put it all together, and how much is there, and where does it go now? And what about all that water? As trillions of gallons flow back to the Gulf, some wonder if there's not a quicker and better way to drain East Texas. And a price tag bigger than Katrina, says the Texas governor. Not so fast, say others in Washington. Now a storm brewing over who and how to pay for the effects of an historic storm. It's Texas Standard Time. When the book is eventually written on Hurricane Harvey, and it will be, don't you worry. Here's hoping that somewhere in those first few pages it is noted for all time that the folks at the National Weather Service Prediction Center absolutely nailed it. They said there would be more than 50 inches of rain. They said it would be unprecedented, beyond anything experienced before. I'm David Brown, and as we begin today's edition of the Texas Standard on this Tuesday, September 5th, 2017, it seems only right to note the newest prediction from the National Weather Service. This issue just a few minutes before we went to the air. Bulletin. National Hurricane Center, Miami, Florida. Irma becomes an extremely dangerous Category 5 hurricane. Preparations should be rushed to completion in the hurricane warning area. Thoughts are with our brothers and sisters in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. An emergency declaration has already been issued for Florida. Maps show that if Irma hits the Sunshine State, it would be around, late Thursday or Friday right now. The fact that this is likely to put a strain on resources dedicated to recovery right here in the Lone Star State certainly turns up the pressure on Harvey-hit Texans to get as much done as possible, as quickly as possible. As the levels in Houston's two main reservoirs continue to drop, piles of saturated sheetrock are forming into small hills along many Texas streets. Texans not waiting for help to start hauling out the furniture and mangled appliances and the toys, that's sometimes the hardest, stripping out the soggy beams and insulation. In Baytown, Exxon's rebooting its refinery, the second biggest in the U.S., but a warning from a leading scholar of such disasters, this is not a sprint, this is a marathon. Susan Cutter is the director of the Hazards and Vulnerabilities Research Center at the University of South Carolina. Professor Cutter, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
You spent the better part of a decade studying the rebuilding efforts in this part of the U.S., most notably after Hurricane Katrina. There's a real race to get things cleaned up and back in order in East Texas. I mean, obviously people want to get on with their lives. How long could it take to get back to normal?
I've heard estimates of anywhere from 10 to 20 years based on the extent of the damage and the number of people affected.
When we say get back to normal, there's this idea that maybe cities can return to the way things were before, but obviously no real guarantees here that people will want to return to some of these areas, clearly. Do you see any obstacles unique to Harvey playing out in this recovery process?
I think we've learned a number of lessons from recovery. First, it takes a long time. The second one is there's a tension between wanting to come back fast versus coming back smart. And if you don't recover smartly, you will see changes. And even if you're not recovering smartly, you will see changes in the community, either through declining populations, a smaller footprint. And what that means is what the region was before Harvey is not what the region will be after Harvey.
We saw that after Katrina, right? I mean, New Orleans, many thousands of people didn't return back to New Orleans after. But that was a sort of a different event, was it not? I mean, there were different dynamics in New Orleans, a place which is much more prone to the sort of flooding that they saw in Katrina than Houston is to the sort of event that we saw with Harvey, right?
That's correct. Every event is unique, although Houston has had a long-term history of flooding that goes back to tropical storms. And the concern and the hope is that the communities do not repeat those mistakes from the past, that you learn from the past. And that means that in your recovery, you think smarter about what you want your community to be, and you encourage people to get flood insurance so that they have the resources when they do come back.
Well,
forgive
me for interrupting, but you've said a couple of times smarter. How do you make a place with few zoning restrictions, for example, like Houston, and already you have a lot of these dimensions on their landscape, the petrochemical industry, for example. How do you rebuild smarter, literally?
What you do is you put and enhance the resilience of your community to effectively withstand smaller kinds of events, not the Harveys, but the smaller events. And that means that if you have flood-prone areas, you elevate your structures so that 6 inches, 12 inches of water doesn't affect them because they're built above the base flood elevation. I think at some point you will have to zone. You will have to have a land use plan that protects people and infrastructure from a wide range of harms. And I think at some point you're going to have to reconcile the discrepancy between those that are most in need in terms of experiencing the most damage and those that are most vulnerable, because it's that population that is the one that's most disproportionately affected, and that includes your renters.
We're getting a lot of reports from places like Victoria, from Houston. Of course, this storm striking when it did at the end of the month, a lot of eviction notices going out.
Yep. And if you think about reconstruction, apartment owners, people who own the buildings, may be more likely, because there's going to be a housing crunch, to turn those apartment buildings into condos rather than apartments for middle to lower income populations. And so where are those populations displaced to?
Is it going to be harder for a place like Houston to rebuild, or someplace like, say, Beaumont or Port Arthur or Aransas Pass? I mean, are there distinctions there?
I think rebuilding is hard everywhere, and it just depends on the community will and community leadership and the resources that they can bring to bear. And those resources are both financial resources, but also community resources. And there's a strong sense of place in Texas, and I think people will want to rebuild, but they're going to have to really think about where they're going to rebuild. And it may not be in that same plot of land. They may have to move to higher ground or further away from water.
Susan Cutter is the director of the Hazards and Vulnerabilities Research Center at the University of South Carolina. Wish we had more time. Professor, thank you for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know, as we just heard, renters may be some of the hardest hit Texans, but the issues are even more daunting for immigrants here without documentation, and they comprise no small part of our population. Stella Chavez of KERA met up with an undocumented couple whose South Houston rental home was trashed by flooding, and they're still waiting for help.
Nancy Vasquez goes through her little girl's shoes, purple sneakers, pink Minnie Mouse slippers, white sandals. Every one of them is wet. Some are moldy. This is the mess left by Harvey inside the family's rental home in Southeast Houston. The night of the flood was terrifying.
Ese día yo no dormí.
I didn't sleep. Around 4 in the morning, I was starting to doze off when I asked him to see what was happening. I could hear the water, and it smelled bad.
Nancy, her husband Johnny, and their 7-year-old daughter Diana prayed. The water was already inside their home. A tree crashed onto the roof, and part of the ceiling cracked open. They knew they had to escape and take their chances walking through chest-deep water. Dad put daughter on his back. He carried their family's white French poodle in one arm and held onto his wife with the other. Nancy was scared. She doesn't know how to swim. Johnny tried to reassure her.
La ansiedad es lo peor enemigo de uno, el miedo. Anxiety and fear is a person's worst enemy. I was trying to tell her that nothing bad was going to happen.
The family eventually reached dry land and waited to be rescued along Interstate 45. Now they spend their days cleaning up the rental home. Their landlord says they have to be out soon. They're staying with a friend from church. They worry about the future.
No tenemos familia.
We don't have family here. We don't have anywhere to go. We have to start over.
Starting over won't be easy. Both parents are undocumented. They say their daughter was born in the U.S., so they should qualify for FEMA help. They've been told by the agency, though, that they can't be approved until Diana's citizenship is verified. They don't know how long that'll be. FEMA confirms that those are the rules, but didn't say how long the process would take. The other problem? Neither of them have been able to work. He works for a company that installs carpet and flooring. He drives a company van, which was damaged in the flood, too.
I've told them my hands are tied. They keep calling me to work, but they're not telling me they're going to get me another car.
Nancy, who was born in Mexico City, is a makeup artist and worked out of their home. Johnny, who's Salvadoran, has money saved up, but it's not nearly enough. Tears flow every time Nancy talks about their situation.
There isn't a lot of help for people like us. We've never asked for assistance, and now that we have, there isn't.
So it's back to cleaning out the house and to waiting. In Houston, I'm Stella Chavez for the Texas Standard.
Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is back in the studio monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. Wells, what do you see?
Hi, David. Well, as expected, the Trump administration announcing what it calls an orderly wind down to the program known as Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, the Obama-era program that allows undocumented people that entered the U.S. as minors to get work permits and receive temporary renewable protection from deportation. Attorney General Jeff Sessions making the announcement as we went to air saying, quote, "We cannot admit everyone that wants to come here. It's that simple." Of course, ending DACA is a politically fraught proposition, as these are a group of innocent, sympathetic people taken into the U.S. when they were children. Lots of reaction on social media to this one, including from one President Donald Trump using Twitter to, you could say, pass the buck. This morning, well in advance of Sessions' announcement, he tweeted, "Congress, get ready to do your job," signaling his hopes Congress addresses the program going forward. I'll have a lot more on this later in the show, David.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to some folks directly affected by this decision. No more applications being accepted for DACA. More of the implications of this policy move ahead as the Texas Standard continues, fast approaching 19 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs are exploring what's possible for the greater good, like Professor Germán Gutiérrez, who uses the power of music to encourage globally responsible citizenship. TCU, lead on.
Business and your money on the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Pulling together the news, as we've just been sharing with you, on DACA, as expected, being phased out. And, of course, the larger issue of undocumented immigrants that we were talking about dealing with the flood issues back in East Texas a few minutes ago. About 1.5 million undocumented immigrants are estimated to live in Texas. But, you know, hard numbers are hard to come by. Folks at the U.S. Census keep trying to tweak their measuring instruments because the stakes can be so high. And in 2020, a first for the census, Americans will be able to submit answers to their census forms online. Now, lots of folks see this as progress, but others consider this problematic. From KUT Austin, Syeda Hassan reports.
On its face, the census might seem like one of the most tedious functions of federal government, but it has major implications for our democracy. The nationwide population count, which happens every 10 years, affects everything from how many seats Texas gets in the U.S. House of Representatives to how much federal funding is allocated for local programs, which is why some experts are wary about the switch to a new high-tech system. John C. Yang is the president and executive director of the nonprofit Asian Americans Advancing Justice.
On one level, the use of new technology is obviously good and should be welcome. There is a concern, however, that unless this technology is tested, we will end up with an inaccurate count.
Last year, funding uncertainty led the Census Bureau to cancel several field tests. It also postponed the opening of some of its field offices. The Bureau says it may consider including those sites in testing next year, but Yang worries that won't be enough.
Any gap in testing and any gap in discovering deficiencies in the use of technology is most likely to affect and hit hard communities of color and other communities that are hard to reach.
Here in Austin, officials are waiting to see how the new digital way of gathering data will affect a few hard-to-reach groups. Austin City demographer Ryan Robinson says that includes college students, the homeless, and immigrants. Robinson says college students should be counted as Austin residents, but many of them don't know that. And calculating the homeless population relies on a single count done on one night of the year. But he expects it's going to be especially hard to accurately count the immigrant population in 2020.
Immigrant populations are often fearful of answering the census form.
Robinson says in previous years, census staff have tried to communicate that they're not interested in people's legal status, that they simply want to count them. He says they've even worked with immigration enforcement to pause raids around Census Day. But he says with the Trump administration's hardline rhetoric around immigration enforcement, there's clearly a heightened sense of fear.
Let's imagine that you're here in this country working without proper documentation. You're probably going to be fearful of a government entity that comes knocking at the door.
And Robinson questions whether a switch to online questionnaires will make immigrant families more likely to respond. In Austin, I'm Saida Hassan for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business on Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a policyholder-owned workers' comp provider helping injured Texans get back to work. More on return-to-work programs at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. So, who is going to pay for this mess? On Fox News Sunday, Governor Greg Abbott said the nearly $8 billion pledged by the Trump administration would only serve as a down payment to what will be needed to recover from Harvey. Governor Abbott said he expected the storm to cost more than Hurricane Katrina, which, if you look back on that figure, is more than $120 billion estimated cost for Harvey. Well, experts have put that total between $150 to $200 billion. So, how does the state and federal government close that financial gap? That's a conversation happening right now between the Pink Dome in Austin all the way up to Capitol Hill in Washington. And Houston Chronicle's Austin Bureau Chief Mike Ward has been tracking it. Good to see you again, Mike.
Good to see you.
$8 billion in federal relief. Has that money already been earmarked, and is it on its way to Texas, or what?
That's the approximate amount of money that the Trump administration has requested, and Congress is scheduled to vote very soon on a initial funding package of about that amount.
Okay. So is there any question about what it is that Governor Abbott is asking for? He is saying that this is going to be, what, $150 billion at least?
At least. There's no firm damage total at this point because there's still flooding going on
right.
In some parts of Texas, south of Houston and in the Beaumont area. And so they're going to have to wait till the water comes down till they can do a full assessment. But this is going to be a big tab.
So if we're talking about that $120 billion figure, which has been raised in the aftermath of Katrina, is that federal money, that money that the feds committed to recovery to Katrina? What is that $120 billion?
That $120 billion is money that the feds contributed to help recovery from Katrina, yes.
Right. Okay, you look at the situation in Texas, and I believe at last check, the death totals, and they have ranged somewhat, close to around 60, I believe.
That's right.
Katrina, you were talking about, I believe it was close to 2,000, ultimately, in terms of the death count. So is it going to be tough for Texas to make the case that this is a disaster of that scale and bigger?
It's probably not going to be tough for Texas to make the case that this is a significant disaster, probably the largest hurricane disaster in terms of damage, because the damage from Harvey stretched all the way from Corpus clear over to the Louisiana border. Huge amounts of damage and devastation. The complicated part of this is twofold. One is at the federal level, Congress is going to have to vote to raise the debt ceiling, which is a tough political issue for a lot of the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a lot of debate over that. At the state level, the state's going to have to pay a lot of money to take care of various things, plus the fact that all the property that has been damaged and destroyed, the property tax revenues are going to drop accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
The sales tax revenues will probably go down some.
So we're talking about long-term implications.
This is long-term implications, but the state's current budget, the revenues probably won't get to where the state thought they were going to be when they wrote the budget.
Well, wait a minute. Don't we have a rainy day fund? We certainly had a few rainy days there.
We've got a rainy day fund. Pretty much without exception so far, people agree that the rainy day fund, this is what it's for. But the rainy day fund has $10 billion in it, and the legislature is probably not going to take all $10 billion out of the rainy day fund. But the current state budget is going to be there's going to be a big impact on it in just decreased revenues, not only for the state, but for the local governments as well.
Okay, so it doesn't look like the state's going to have all the resources clearly that it's going to need. So you're going to have to return to the federal government.
Right.
If we're talking about turning to the federal government at a time when already there's tension between Capitol Hill and the president over how you're going to, you know, this debt ceiling that you mentioned, possibility of shutting down the government because there are differences over what to do about Obamacare. How likely is it that money for Harvey is going to get through that? You have a thread and needle there.
At some point, the federal government is going to come up with money to make Texas whole.
At some point.
The question is, what is that point? Whether it will be in small chunks of money appropriated over a period of time, or whether it's going to be larger chunks, or maybe probably not one chunk, but maybe. But it's expensive, and government is stretching already, both state government and the federal government. And just remember, there's another storm coming into the Caribbean right now, Irma, that could complicate this thing further.
Well, we are going to be covering this story, and you can bet that Mike Ward, Austin Bureau Chief for the Houston Chronicle, is watching it as well. We'll have a link to his latest, texasstandard.org. Mike, thanks so much for all you're doing. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Roundup of all the news that's making news in Texas just ahead. Texas Roundup. Stay with us.
From the Texas Standard Newsroom, I'm Becky Fogle with a roundup of news from across the state. The U.S. House of Representatives will vote Wednesday on emergency relief funding for victims of Hurricane Harvey. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy made the announcement yesterday at Houston's NRG Center, which is now serving as an emergency shelter. McCarthy, a California Republican, said this would be the first aid package.
I also want to make the point, it won't be the only relief package we vote on. What we want to do is make sure FEMA has the money going forward as the cities and the counties assess the damage.
Texas Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz, along with much of the Houston congressional delegation, joined McCarthy for the announcement. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has estimated the total damage from Harvey could cost as much as $180 billion. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice is starting to repopulate prisons evacuated due to flooding caused by Harvey. Last Tuesday, the state agency announced that it had moved almost 6,000 inmates from 5 units in Fort Bend and Brazoria counties. A couple days later, TDCJ released a video update on where those inmates had been moved. Here's the agency's director, Brian Collier.
Those offenders have been placed on other locations throughout the state. I believe 19 units have offenders from those locations. We have also evacuated a halfway house in Corpus Christi, a treatment facility in Victoria, a halfway house in Houston, Texas, Beaumont, Texas, as well as another treatment facility in Beaumont, Texas.
About 1,400 inmates were returned to the all-male Jester 3 and Vance units in Richmond on Monday. The other three prisons that house about 4,500 people are still evacuated. Beaumont has found a temporary workaround to restore water service to the city. It lost its water supply on August 31st after flooding caused by Tropical Storm Harvey knocked out the city's primary and backup water pumps. Becky Ames is the mayor of Beaumont. At a press conference Monday, Ames called the workaround miraculous.
Our water pumping is completely underwater, and our great employees, along with industry, have done a workaround that will last us until the river recedes and we can get our pumps back back in operation.
That audio is courtesy of the local Fox affiliate station in Beaumont. Companies like Tiger Industries and ExxonMobil helped get 6 pumps into place at the end of last week that are refilling the city's water plant. A boil water notice from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality is still in effect for Beaumont and many other areas throughout southeast Texas. That's Look at News from across the state. I'm Becky Fogle for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas Standard headlines comes from the law firm of Barron Adler Clough & Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's hard to visualize trillions of gallons of water getting dumped on a single city like Hurricane Harvey did to Houston. And it's maybe more difficult to picture all that water just disappearing. But the Bayou City's mostly dry now. Perhaps disappear isn't quite the right word, though, because all that water didn't just vanish. It had to go somewhere, obviously. But where exactly? Joining us now to answer that question is Jim Blackburn. He is the co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center, the SPEED Center, at Rice University. Jim, welcome to the Texas Standard.
No, thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
I would just assume that most of those waters went back into the Gulf of Mexico. That's got to be the right answer.
Yep. No, it is the right answer. We are right on the Gulf of Mexico. Galveston Bay is our back door, and most of the water ran off fairly quickly. We've still got some continuing flooding areas near the Attic and Barker reservoirs, but our smaller bayous going through town have pretty well drained out by now.
Houston got over 50 inches of rain thanks to Harvey. Did it drain as quickly as the experts were saying, or as you expected, or not so much?
Well, I don't know that anyone expected that much rain to drain quickly. I mean, we flood with lesser storms than Harvey. I'm not sure there's a city in the United States that could have survived Harvey without significant damage. But I think that the lesson from Harvey is that we need more space for water to move through the city, and that we need to add a lot of different ideas to the basic engineering approach that we've been taking these many years. So we have a lot of lessons to learn here and a lot of work to do to get it straightened out.
Well, I mean, let's not be so abstract as just to say we need to think about some other ideas to get water out. Give us an idea. What's something that Houston is not considering, maybe because it seems too out there? I mean, unless something changes, of course, right? I mean, you're going to have the same problem over and over again. So what would you point to if you're looking for some new way to deal with this?
First of all, we need to know what didn't flood. That's going to be the spine of future development in Houston. There are areas that have flooded multiple times. I think we're going to have to buy out a lot of the homes that have been flooded 3 times, 4 times in the last several years, and just remove them from harm's way because we're just not going to be able to protect them. To the west, we have a lot of really valuable wetlands and native prairie, and we're going to have to find creative ways to save that. Probably one of the most creative is a concept called buying and selling of ecological services, where the landowner can sell flood storage perhaps as a resource, or even if you won't think of it as a crop. And another thing we think that will be coming up for sale very quickly is the ability to take carbon dioxide out of the air and put it into the soil. This is basically harnessing the power of nature. Nature, through photosynthesis, naturally takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and turns it into carbohydrates, plant material, and much of that ends up down into the soil. And there are certain techniques that you can undertake to really enhance the amount of carbon dioxide that gets sequestered in the soil. And that is going to be gold to the oil and gas industry of the future, because they're going to be under increasing pressure to take carbon dioxide out. And although we don't like to talk about climate change much in Houston, most of the oil companies are very serious about what their options are for long-term issues about climate change. So those are a few of the ideas. There are many more.
Boy. Well, we've seen reports of the floodwater. You were mentioning the petrochemical industry, concerns about possible chemicals that can be found there getting into the water supply. What sort of threat does that pose, if not to the water supply per se, to the ecosystems in the creeks and the bayous, that sort of thing?
Well, I think there's going to be isolated instances where there may be leaks or perhaps a tank spills or pipeline ruptures, but that really hasn't been a major issue here. This was a rainfall storm. And it actually is not the worst case storm that could hit this region. The worst case storm would be one that hit a lot closer as a Category 4 coming ashore near Galveston Bay and would push a big surge tide up into the Galveston Bay and Houston Ship Channel system. And we've been doing modeling over at Speed Center at Rice for some time on this storm. And you know, our estimates are a 25-foot surge could release upwards of 90 million gallons of oil and hazardous substances from 2,200 storage tanks that are exposed to flooding at that level. And that would be probably the worst environmental disaster in United States history, not to mention shutting down much of the refining and chemical capacity in the United States. So as bad as Houston got hit, it wasn't the worst case that we have at least modeled at Speed Center at Rice. So that's another dimension that has to be addressed as well. So Houston's got a lot of work to do.
Jim Blackburn is a co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction Education and Evacuation from Disaster Center at Rice University, the Speed Center. Professor Blackburn, thank you for spending a few minutes with the Standard.
No, you bet, David. It's a real pleasure, and thanks for taking the interest.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas, offering a pair of plans that can help families save toward college dreams. More at SaveNowForCollege.org.
This is Evelyn Weatherby. I live in Port Christie. I'm 74. I am retired. I taught elementary music and boys' choirs for about 40 years. And I am now in Austin with my son and his wife and family until we are going to go home after chemo because I'm having chemo in the Texas Oncology Department. We travel a great deal of the time. We haven't been since we got back from Greece, Macedonia, Albania, and Serbia in March, and that's when I was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. But so it was kind of a shock. Our children were horrified that we were planning on staying through the hurricane. They said, no, your health is compromised. You cannot stay in case there's no water, and you don't want to stay without any air conditioning. Well, we've done it before, but they insisted, and they kept on insisting and badgering us until we finally came up. So I said, I'm big trouble now because Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday I'm supposed to have a shot of Granix each day to raise the white blood cells. And so my oncologist in Corpus Christi and my surgeon here in Austin talked to each other and figured out that we could do all that up here. That worked out great. And I'm sitting in a big stuffed reclining chair with chemo dripping into my arm. If you either can cry about it or you can laugh about it, that's why I choose the latter. I didn't know this could even happen. I thought, well, I'm going to have to miss chemo, which does not make me happy because those little cancer cells are getting real busy while the chemo is about happening. I'm impatient to be back to my old, very active self. It's wearing me out. But I'm usually extremely active. I exercise at the Y an hour a day, doing things like weightlifting and powerlifting and aerobics and core training and stuff that's hard that I come away in a sweat by that time. And I haven't been able to do any of that since this all started in March, and I miss it. I want to get back to me. This is Evelyn Weatherby, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The Lufkin Thundering 13, number one in the nation, the best in all of Little League Baseball in the whole U.S. and A. Don't know if you followed their trajectory this summer, but what a thrill. The hashtag Thundering 13 on Twitter messages of support that came from the likes of Texas Governor Greg Abbott and baseball pros like San Francisco Giants first baseman Brandon Belt. Well, granted, the Thundering 13 did lose the Little League World Series championship to Japan, but as Davis Land reports, when the 13 came thundering back home to a community drenched by Harvey, well, Lufkin overflowed with excitement for its hometown heroes.
What you're hearing right now is the sound of several thousand people crowded into the George H. Henderson Jr. Expo Center in Lufkin, Texas. They were there to welcome the Thundering 13 home. Let it sink in, these are the National Little League champions. Inside the center, an enormous American flag hung from two fire department ladder trucks, and each of the 13 players rode in individually on the back of a pickup to their own walk-on songs. If that doesn't sound like an over-the-top welcoming, get this. Over the course of the two-hour celebration, state and local politicians, including State Representative Trent Ashby, congratulated the players and awarded them certificates, custom baseball bats, and flags that have flown above the state capitol. The players are only 12 and 13 years old. Their faces were in awe throughout the night. Clayton Wigley is one of them. He says he trained to win, but this was beyond his wildest dreams.
Thought we had a good chance and never realized it was going to go this far.
Just making it to the World Series is something new for Lufkin. If the town is really known for something, it would be football, not baseball. Jeff Buchanan is the father of pitcher and third baseman Chip Buchanan. He put it this way.
You have a minute of reflection saying, what just happened? Did that really happen? And you're just, you know, it's kind of like a dream. I wake up sometimes and think, I can't believe that really happened. Because as a kid growing up, you always dream about the Little League World Series and you watch it on TV.
This time, he and his wife, Heather Buchanan, watched it live in Pennsylvania. It was huge for them, but they didn't realize at the time just how much the win would mean for Lufkin. Heather Buchanan knew it meant the world to Lufkin when they got back into town. Even though Hurricane Harvey was pounding, dozens of people braved the rain and lined up along the streets to get a glimpse of her son Chip, the rest of the Thundering 13, and their police escort.
We've been isolated. You know, we've been in Williamsport, and a lot of people have come, but nothing like seeing the whole town show up for you. And like this tonight, I mean, he'll have this forever.
One phrase I've heard over and over throughout the speeches and congratulations of the night was that this win was a result of a community effort. Bud Maddox is a veteran baseball coach in Lufkin with a 40-year career and is also manager of the Thundering 13.
That's the type of community this is and always has been. They appreciate winners on and off the field, and they support them. Good people, and that's what it's all about.
Since the community is not just these champions, but also the people deeply affected by Hurricane Harvey, Tara Watson Watkins decided the celebration for the Thundering 13 would double as a relief effort for hurricane survivors. Watson Watkins is with the Lufkin Convention and Visitors Bureau.
We could not be gathered together with this many people at the Exposition Center and not do something for all of the victims from Harvey.
Donations from attendees filled two 18-wheelers. At the end of the night, they drove off to Beaumont in Houston. The team also raised thousands of dollars in t-shirts and donated the money to the cause. Now, you would think that these celebrity athletes would just take it easy for now, but that would be a misconception. This is the week when they start their new school year at different schools, and just like everyone else, they must try out and see if they make it onto their school's baseball teams. Something tells me these national winners will do just fine. In Lufkin, I'm Davis Land for the Texas Standard.
Well, the Houston Rockets about to change hands in a record-breaking deal. Houston billionaire Tillman Fertitta has confirmed he's going to be purchasing the NBA team for $2.2 billion from current owner Leslie Alexander. Now, that price tag tops the $2 billion that Steve Ballmer paid for the Clippers back in 2014, making this the priciest ever NBA sale. Fertitta is the chairman and CEO of that national hospitality group known as Landry's, Inc. He's also the chairman of the University of Houston Board of Regents. Alexander bought the Rockets in 1993 for $85 million. That's 1/25 of what he's going to get for it. It's what you call return on investment. Come on and take a free ride, Edgar Winter used to say. Well, the Via Metropolitan Transit of San Antonio providing free bus rides all day today. Because why? Because of that gas shortage, which we've been told wasn't really a shortage, but goodness knows it felt like one.
Long lines at the pump started happening late last week when supplies from refineries in East Texas got backed up during the Harvey mess, right? Well, things are going back online. The lines are getting shorter outside, the gas pumps. But San Antonio Current reports that fixed route bus service, park and ride service, via trans trips, all are going to be offered for free to help sort of ease some of the pinch. It's expected fuel supplies will be back to normal very soon. 49 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Children's Hospital, located deep in the heart of Houston and home to more than 40 pediatric subspecialties, providing care for Texas kids and to children from across the country and around the world. Learn more at texaschildrens.org.
Hello, Texas. You got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
And that was U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions within the past hour, officially rescinding the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. Jeff Sessions made the announcement today in Washington, confirming the Trump administration will indeed wind down DACA within the next 6 months. Now, Sessions has called this program a failure to enforce immigration laws, and he said that it was overreach of the executive branch under, of course, President Obama. With the rescinding of DACA, the U.S. government will not be accepting any new applicants to the program. And as for those already signed up, well, they will get until October 5th to file for renewal. But then the clock has already started ticking, has it not? Department of Homeland Security will be providing this six-month window in which it'll be adjudicating the renewal process for DACA recipients. And following this DACA announcement today, we are joined by two recipients of the program to get their reaction, hear what they plan to do next. Daniel Ramirez graduated from Middlebury College in May with a degree in philosophy, grew up in Houston, now lives in Austin. Daniel, can you hear us there?
Yes, sir.
When did you arrive in the United States? Tell us a bit more about your story.
So my father moved to the United States after I was born, and after he saved up a bit of money, he paid for us to come join him. I was 18 months at the time. Mm-hmm. And he thought that we would just come and see the United States for 2 weeks on a tourist visa. But we ended up staying for 20 years now. And he originally wanted us to just see the roads. He would talk about the roads a lot, the public libraries. And he just happened to stop by an elementary school, mm-hmm. and ask if he could enroll his kids. And it turns out that he didn't need a social security number to enroll your kids in a public school. So we started there.
Your reaction to today's news?
So I'm really disappointed, I guess. But I think I'm almost a little optimistic. I hope that after 6 months we can see something even better than DACA, because DACA, although it absolutely changed my family's life and my siblings' lives, it wasn't much. It wasn't a road to citizenship. It wasn't the right to vote. It didn't guarantee you much other than like the ability to have a job, to work, and to have a license. But I'm a little anxious.
It sounds like you're pinning a lot of your hopes on Congress.
Right. Yeah. I just don't want to be too pessimistic. I don't want to have that weigh me down. Because since I've been here in Austin, I've become part of the advocacy community here, and seeing how much support there is for people in my situation and people of my community, I hope that the DACA reform and the way DACA recipients choose to talk about it,
right.
It doesn't mean, yeah.
I want to bring in Berenice Ramirez. She is a University of Texas student who, as I understand it, Berenice, you're working on getting a degree as a certified registered nurse?
Yes, sir, I am.
So tell us a little bit about your story. You came here when you were two.
Yes, I was. I came here when I was two. My father was a migrant farm worker for years before we came to the United States. He worked in Tennessee. He worked all over Texas. And we wouldn't see him for months, right? And so my mom just finally decided, like, hey, I don't want this type of life for my kids. They need their father. They need to grow up with a father figure. They need their family together. And that's sort of like the core value of like a lot of Latinos, right, is family. So that's when she decided to, you know, pack our bags and head off. But originally she actually migrated to the United States while my dad was here with my oldest sister and my oldest brother. And they actually swam across the river. Me and one of my oldest sisters were separated from them for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a year before we saw them again. When they also brought us over here.
Berenice, I hate to interrupt. I'm looking at our clock, and we're about to run out of time this hour, but I have to ask quickly for your reaction to today's announcement. What do you do next?
Like Daniel, I definitely want to be optimistic about it. I'm slightly relieved by the fact that Donald Trump didn't actually abruptly end DACA right away. There's still time. Like you said, to leave it up to Congress, right? I know that this is a very trying, difficult, and a depressing moment for our undocumented community. I also know that, you know, my community is very strong, it's very powerful and resilient, and that these coming days, weeks, and months, we're going to stand together stronger than ever and really pressure them to stand on the right side of history and protect dreamers like me and Daniel. And we're not backing down. If anything, I know that I will use all of this, frustration, this anger, this sadness that I'm feeling right now to work harder than ever before and really organize and mobilize my community to win the protection that we deserve.
That is the voice of Berenice Ramirez and, of course, Daniel Ramirez, who graduated from Middlebury College in May with a degree in philosophy. Berenice is a currently University of Texas student who's working on getting a degree as a certified registered nurse. We're getting reaction from all across Texas. We have to bring in our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are Texans saying right now?
Hi, David. Sorry about that. Hi, David. Yes, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about the Trump administration announcement rescinding DACA. You know, David, we're hearing lots from educators because apparently educators seemingly encounter a lot of these DACA students in their line of work. Here's someone we heard from on our Facebook page. Peggy Jean says, I've taught many of these kids, and she adds that DACA recipients work hard, pass criminal background checks, and go to school. Some work 2 to 3 jobs to attend college. They get no financial aid, but they understand it's all up to them. All they need is a chance to work and attend school. You know, David, there's also the question of what's next. Obviously, the program looks to be rescinded in 6 months, although there is this expectation now on Congress that they may take the bill up and protect the program. On our Facebook page, Nicole LeBlanc writes, I think that with a ticking clock, we may actually see a bipartisan bill of some sort. With the Obama executive order still in court, the only way to make sure these kids have a path to citizenship is for Congress to act. Just a couple of the responses. There's a lot more going on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Texas Standard.
Yes, we are getting your tweets right now. We would love to continue to receive them at Texas Standard. And Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, continues to monitor the talk of Texas. You can keep up with the news at texasstandard.org. And make sure you join us right here on the radio again tomorrow. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard team, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Additional philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Ben Benson Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.